Hello and welcome to the Buyer Insights Podcast, a show about how and why people buy. I'm your host, Liston Witherell, CEO of GoodFunnel, a digital marketing agency. Check us out on the web at goodfunnel.co. You can listen to all episodes of the Buyer Insights Podcast. We've had really, really fantastic guests, and you can hear those at goodfunnel.co/podcast, or of course, subscribe in iTunes or the podcasting app of your choice. And you can grab the show notes from today's episode there as well. Today, I'm very, very excited to have a very influential author for me who's written a book called The Brain Audit. He also runs a website called psychotactics.com, and his name is Sean D'Souza. Sean started out as a cartoon artist, which he'll tell you all about, but he moved on to copywriting and really now teaches all about marketing and persuasion and the science of how we communicate what it is that we do in a way that really resonates with our buyers. One thing that I love about Sean, which he doesn't get into in this episode, is that he wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning, which is really mind-blowing to me. I'm still working on getting up at 5:30 a.m., so that's my immediate goal. Sean calls himself the Chief Brain Auditor, and you can find him, like I said, at psychotactics.com. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Sean. I'm here with Sean D'Souza. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, I've told you in the pre-interview that I'm really excited to have you on because your book, The Brain Audit, was really instrumental in helping me learn about copywriting and marketing and really the process of how to acclimate people to your company and to a message that you have to convey. So I'm really interested to talk to you about that. But first, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you started as a cartoon artist and made it to where you are today?
I always liked to draw, and I guess that made me popular in a way, got me my attention. But I think the reason why I started drawing was because I was a very shy kid, and so I just read and draw, and on occasion people would say, "Oh, you draw so well," so that continued. But when I got to New Zealand, which was in the year 2000, I had read a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins, and he asked, what can you be the best in the world at? And it's not a question that you take lightly, and it's very frustrating in a way, because it's like, I don't know the answer to that question. But what I did know was that Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip, was the best in the world. And at least back then in 2000, I thought I couldn't beat that. If I went about it today, I might come close. But at that point in time, I decided that's it. Now, I'd already been drawing for 15 years as a cartoonist. I was already earning an income both in India and then in New Zealand. But I'm also a firm believer in the concept of the diversion. And the diversion is something where you don't prepare to be there. And a lot of people get upset because they have to go down a diversion. And I really like diversions. I like being there because it's where life puts you. And it's exactly where you need to be. So at that point in time, I decided, okay, so what can I be the best in the world at? And I didn't have the answer. I went to several networking meetings here because I didn't know anyone in New Zealand. And that was the only way I could find out. What happened was that I used to go to this group called BNI, and they used to have this kind of thing that they called a dance. You would go and meet the other person at their premises, and they'd tell you what they did. And usually people speak for 30 minutes when they're trying to tell you what they did. What I would do was try to encapsulate everything in a single line. And I did that once, I did that twice, and people would say, wow, you're really good at this, but you don't pay attention. But when 20 people say that, and there were like 35 people in the group, so over several months, I got this feeling that, wait a second, they seem to be seeing something I don't. And that's when I changed over from cartooning to marketing, And I didn't know where I was going, but I just decided that marketing was what I wanted to do. So I started up a website, which was horrendously named. It was called Million Bucks. It's something that I don't. It's very embarrassing. But that's what it was called back then. And in 2002, we changed it to Psychotactics. And now it's 2016.
And you're still publishing on Psychotactics regularly, and you have a variety of courses. And you talk a lot about how this idea of how people make decisions, and I'm referring, of course, to The Brain Audit, which is the book that you wrote, which is absolutely fantastic, and I recommend that anybody read it. Can you tell us a little bit about how the process that you lay out in The Brain Audit and how you arrived at this as being the process to really convey your message, particularly through copy and messaging?
So I don't create any products or courses or anything for anybody else. I do it precisely for myself. It's just to clarify my own mind, because I don't want to, I believe in speeding things up, or at least having benchmarks in place so I know I've checked out stuff. And what I did was I sat down and I wrote these points. At that point, back in 2002, I wasn't really sure that I wanted to be a copywriter. I wanted to write a book on, you know, why customers buy. But what I figured was, if I went through all the old ads, and there are lots of ads from 1920, 1930, and if I just went through all of them with a yellow marker, then I would find out some kind of secret. And then, of course, there were marketers like Jay Abraham at that point in time sending you pages and pages of stuff. And every time I was interested in something, I would put the yellow marker and try to figure out what he was doing at that point in time. And I found that consistently certain things came up, and that a lot of marketing that was happening in the real world was not consistent with that. And so what I defined in The Brain Audit was the problem, the solution, the target, which I called audience before, but really now we have changed it several years ago to target profile, which is totally different from target audience or any persona or any of that imaginary stuff. So we had problem, solution, target profile, and then the risk factors, which is objections, testimonials, risk reversal, and uniqueness. I found this to be consistent in almost every great ad, every ad that had converted. And I have a book on the 100 best-selling ads over history, or the last 150 years, and they all have the same concept. But what gave me great satisfaction was when I went to a workshop, a copywriting workshop, and the guy was running ads. He was running headlines, and he said which headline worked. So he had a book, I think, or some kind of slideshow back then about headlines, you know, that we tested this headline versus that headline, which one worked. And I got 20 out of 20 correct. And he was like, that is surely a fluke. When people wrote these headlines, they didn't know that. And I said, no, I have a system. And of course, he didn't believe me. I've met with the CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi in New Zealand at that point in time. I told him the same thing. He said, you know, that takes all the fun out of creativity, which to me sounds nonsense, right? Essentially, when you look at a chair is built on signs. And then you can build, you can, as long as you conform to the signs, you can build a chair in different shapes and different forms. And to me, creativity is the layer above the signs. And so I found that these seven things, which I called seven red bags because I created a story around it, I found that those were consistent. Those were the things that were consistent. And the first thing that people were making mistakes was really the first part. So really I break The Brain Audit into two parts. The first part is the attraction, and the second part is the risk factor.
Can you talk a little bit about the attraction?
So the analogy goes like this. The Brain Audit is, it's imagine you're on a flight and you take 7 red bags and you put them on the plane, and then you get off at your destination. And then when you get off on the other side, you're waiting for your bags. And so the first red bag comes out, you take it off. The second red bag comes off, you take it off. Then you get a green bag, a yellow bag, polka dot bag. Finally, the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth bag come out. So the question is, when do you leave the airport? Now, we all know that no one leaves the airport if there's a bag missing. And the analogy goes that this is approximately what happens in the customer's brain. If you don't remove all the bags, they don't buy. They go into this tailspin. They want to ask somebody. It's a lot of hesitation. And so the first 3 bags, when you look at them, are the problem, the solution, and the target profile. And most people, what they start off with is the solution. So if you ask someone, what do? They spit out their solution. And the brain doesn't really respond to a solution like it responds to a problem. So if you look at the 3 bags, the first bag is really the target profile. So the target profile is someone like, say, Ramon. And Ramon has a specific problem. And that problem is that his website is great, but he doesn't know how to use several of the features. So he feels like an owner of the house, and he feels like some of the rooms are locked. Some of the rooms in his own house are locked, and he doesn't have the key. So now that's a very specific kind of person. That's Ramon, a real person. And that's what a target profile is. It's not this persona. It's not an audience. It's one person, Ramon. And you can go to lunch with Ramon and speak to him, and this is what he tells you. He tells you, this is my problem. And then you say, Ramon, what would you like to have? And he says, I would like to have the keys to the rest of the rooms, so I knew what was in the rooms and how to use it. And what you have there is a specific target profile, a person, a real person, the problem they're having, and then the solution. So these 3 factors are the attraction factors. When you understand, if you just said, what we do is we build websites which help you run your business. Well, that's a solution, but that's not a great solution. But if you ask a question is, do you sometimes feel like a stranger in your own website where you don't know half the things, you know, where you don't know how to run half the things? Do you feel locked out, you know, like someone in their own house? Now what you're doing is you are getting into the mindset of a very frustrated owner of a website. And that gets my attention because it's a specific problem. It's not generic. And so these 3 bags, whenever they come together in that order, target profile, problem, and solution, they create interest. And so that's why I'd call it the attraction section, the first 3 bags.
Okay.
I
was just going to say, before we get to the risk section, there, you know, we're always looking at how all of this information that people can collect now is changing their buying habits. We know certainly that people do a lot more research before they engage with sales or marketing or even entertain a buying decision now. Do you think that these first 3 factors will change over time as the way businesses can market and sell to people changes, or do you think there's something essentially human about them?
They haven't changed for thousands of years in the sense that the brain is pretty much hardwired to seek out problems. So you don't have to do any spectacular test for it. You just have to close a door. And the moment the door was open and now the door is closed, your brain recognizes that fact and it knows that it's a problem. That if you keep walking, you're going to slam into the door and you're going to hit your nose. So it looks for a solution and it looks for the door handle. And, you know, when you walk down the street, there are lots of things to see, but the brain is looking for all the potholes. It's looking for the stuff that's in the way. You know, it's looking for this crazy person that's headed towards you. It's looking for dog poo. You know? So,
yeah, I had someone in my shoe this morning. That was not fun.
And, yeah. So it recognizes it is the reason why it looks for problems is very simple. A problem can kill you. If you're dead, you're no use to anybody really. So it tries to keep you alive, and therefore we're always looking for problems, even though we say we don't like problems, but we're always looking to avoid the problem. And so if you don't bring up the problem, then all you have is a solution. And I'm not, unless I identify the problem in the first place, I can't get to the solution. So you look at something as generic as, say, for instance, electric cars. So electric cars solve a specific problem today, which is, cars running on gasoline are pollutants, are polluting the atmosphere. They cause lots of health issues, besides other things that we won't go into. But why would I buy one electric car? Why would I buy, say, a BMW i3 over a Tesla if I could buy it? And so the Tesla solves a completely different problem from an i3. But I have to know that. If I just say, hey, here's an electric car, it's a wonderful electric car, you might be interested because now electric cars are new, but in the long run, when everyone has the option for an electric car, it has to be different. And the difference between an i3 and a Tesla is just size. I mean, the Tesla is built like a bus. It's huge. And an i3 is a subcompact. So immediately, what people are looking for, the people that are concerned with that specific, that target profile that's interested in size, will want one over the other. The people that are interested in, say, which is the more efficient car, well, it takes, if you just plug the car into your mains, into your socket, which is just the same one as your toaster, it takes 2 days to charge a Tesla. It takes about 20 hours to charge an i3. So that's another thing. There are all of these specific problems that it solves. And if you just try to sell it a product like a computer or a car or a course or anything just with a generic solution, you are less likely to get the customer's attention because it's generic. That's why it's not getting their attention.
Right, yeah. And so once you get their attention with the problem and then you start talking about the solution, you were talking about risk factors or risks that need to be addressed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the moment a client is attracted, then they get afraid. So the moment you are attracted towards buying a car, that's when you go into this fear factor, which is what could go wrong. So, and it's in real life as well. You know, you go in, supposing you meet someone, you go on a date. This is no problem. Once you get past the attraction stage and there is some level of commitment to be done, that's when you start doing all the checking up. So if you were to buy a car or a computer, the first thing that comes up are the objections. It's like, do I really need this car? Where can I charge the car? Say for electric cars, where do I charge the car? What happens if this happens? And so you come up with a whole bunch of objections. That's the first thing that shows up. The second thing is the testimonial. So you want to know who else has done this, who else has run into these problems, and how have they solved it. So the point is that the testimonials are really the mirror image of the objections. So if you're ever going to have testimonials on your sales page or promotional material, you want to look at the objections. If the objection is, well, I don't know because there aren't so many chargers, then your testimonial should say, well, when I was trying to buy this car, this is the kind of problem, this is the kind of issue that I had, but here's what I found. There are like 300 chargers all over the city. So you're really dealing with the exact mirror issue, which is, this is the objection, and you kill the objection anyway. But then when you get the testimonials, you get them from clients that have had those specific objections. And so it kind of reduces the risk twice. So you have objections, you have testimonials, and of course there is a whole wealth of information on just how to construct a great testimonial. But in the brain audit, you get 6 questions that you can ask any client, and you probably get about 300 words in response to those 6 questions, which give you an insight into the customer that you never had before. So objections, testimonials. Now the third thing in that bag list and is risk reversal. And you say, well, if the whole thing is about risk, then
why bother with risk reversal as a separate issue? But the thing is that people, they don't want their money back. Most of us say, well, here's your money back. They want you to recognize that they're feeling something that you don't, that's not just about money back, because they had their money before they gave it to you. It's not like they wanted your stuff. They already had their money and they've given it to you. They're expecting some kind of benefit. So when you look at, say, for instance, Zappos, what made Zappos so popular? I mean, sure, they were one of the few people selling shoes at the time, but the thing that they understood was the biggest risk that people had wasn't that the shoe wouldn't fit them. That was one of the risks. The biggest risk was the unspoken risk, which is that I will have to get the shoe, then if I have to return it, even though they have a, you know, return policy, I'll have to go back and then I'll have to put it in the box, and that's all too much trouble. So they recognized that issue and they made that their biggest risk reversal, which is two-way shipping. If you don't like it, put it in a box, we'll collect it. So that makes it easy for me now. It's not just a money back. It's understanding what's happening. Right now, we don't sell any physical products, or we don't sell many physical products, but early in around 2000, 2002, we used to ship, you know, whole books and CDs and stuff like that. And what we found was that when people returned it, the books and the CDs were in impeccable condition. They were they were in such a good condition that you could say that they were shipped straight from the factory, as it were. And what we realized was that people weren't even opening it. They were afraid to use the CDs and read the books because they would get them soiled, and so then they would not get their money back. And what we did was we created what is called the lawnmower guarantee, which is essentially you take your lawnmower, you run it over the books, you run it over the CDs, put everything in a box and send it back. And so the refund rate just went down because people started using it. So, but the thing is to recognize the risk and not get lazy and go, okay, just let's give them their money back. No, that's not how it works. And finally, you have when you have all of this stuff in place, which is the problem solution, target profile, the biggest objections, risk reversal, and testimonials, what you've done is just set it up for the customer to go to competition. So what you've got to do at this point in time is you have to make sure that you have a uniqueness factor. And this drives a lot of people crazy. But the book, the Brain Audit, explains how you go about creating a uniqueness. And there are YouTube videos online, which at Psychotactics, you can look at it, which explain the entire process of how you could go about creating a uniqueness instead of just trying to find a uniqueness. So you create a uniqueness. You, instead of saying, you know, what's unique about us, you say, well, if I were to create a product, this is how I'd go about it. This is how I'd go about creating a uniqueness about our product or service. And that removes all the risk. These 4 factors, which is objections, testimonial, risk reversal, and uniqueness, that reduces the risk. And that's the diving board for the customer to go, okay, let's click this buy now button and see how it works.
And so on the issue of uniqueness, do you recommend that people, as they're, let's say they already have a successful business, but they're looking at the brain audit as a tool to increase their foothold or maybe carve out a sharper and more defined niche. Do you recommend that they just create something themselves, or also maybe look externally and look for holes in the competition or in the market, some unmet need in terms of uniqueness?
I think you could do both. Now, we were doing an article writing course for several years, and it would take at least a couple of weeks to fill up the course. Now, a few years ago, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, a client did the course and she said, "This is the toughest writing course in the world." And she then went on to describe it. She said, "It's like, you know, it's like baby tough." And I said, "What do you mean by baby tough?" And she said, "Well, when you have a cat, the cat pretty much takes care of itself. And when you have a dog, you have to do some maintenance. But babies, you have to be there all the time." And she says, "This course is baby tough." And we put that on our website. Now, when we sold the course the next year, it sold out in an hour. So nothing had changed. The course material hadn't changed. The presenter hadn't changed. The notes hadn't changed. The syllabus hadn't changed. The only thing that changed was this one thing. That it was the toughest writing course in the world. And you think it would push everybody away. But, you know, there are, people are looking for something that makes them decide, "I'm going to go for this instead of that." And if you're going to stand out, you don't always have to be in your face like this course. You can just, I have to be able to describe, like, you know, I drive the i3 and I can tell you why I don't ever want to look at a Tesla. I mean, it's a great car. Everybody loves it. Fine. But I can tell you the difference. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you the difference between many cars. They're just like, if you just put your sign over the logo, you can't tell which car it is, or you can't tell which product it is. You know, it's just completely, it can be swapped over by the competition. What we've done at Psychotactics is even though I wrote the brain audit, it's an evolving process, and you get to a point where you're very comfortable with it. And what we found our uniqueness was that we don't just give you information. So you can buy stuff all over the internet, and you get information and bonuses and more interviews. And what we do is we give you skill. So if it takes 100 pages to give you that skill, you get 100 pages. If it takes you 20 pages, you get 20 pages. If it gets you 3 pages, you get 3 pages. But instead of more information, we give you skill. And immediately an audience goes, or a client goes, "That's what I want. I don't really want to read 100 pages. I don't even want to read 20 pages. If you can give it to me in 3 pages, that's great." So that has become the uniqueness, because we decided that's what we want to do. And I was like everybody else. I would write a book that, you know, was minimum 200 pages. One course I was doing on uniqueness itself, the book stopped at 90 pages. And I told my wife, Renuka, I said, "I can't go past 90 pages. And she says, "90 pages? That's a lot of stuff." So
she had a totally different perspective than you did.
Exactly. And then last year we did the storytelling course in Nashville and then in Amsterdam. And the book stopped, I think, at 60 pages. And when I said it stopped at 60 pages, she had the same reaction. It was like, 60 pages is enough for me, you know? It's like, you're asking me to read 60 pages and come to this workshop. That's a lot. So the client was more interested in getting to that skill factor, and they're not interested in how many pages. The people that are counting pages, they're not our type of client. And to get to your question, what should you do? You could, in the first instance, the client found that uniqueness. It was already a very tough course. They just put a label to it. They described it. That's what worked for us. In the case of the second one, we created that uniqueness. It didn't exist, as it were. And what we did was we created it. We said, from now on, if it's going to take 20 pages, it's going to take 20 pages. We're only going to give you skill, not information, not just information. And I don't know if either one is superior. Like, when you think of the most celebrated uniqueness of all time, it's Domino's Pizza. And it's like, surely that didn't exist. They created it. They said, okay, how do we get there in 30 minutes, or we have to give them their money back? Because no pizza. At that point, all they had to do, I mean, this is the 70s, and no one was delivering pizza on time. It would take hours to get a pizza. So all they had to do was deliver a pizza on time. But no, they decided they're not just going to look at loopholes in the competition. They're going to set a benchmark, which is 30 minutes. And that's what they did. So they created it, and it made them $1 billion.
It sure did. And it's such an easy offer and a thing to understand. Get your pizza in 30 minutes or less, or it's free. So some people listening to this, Sean, may, and maybe you've heard this before, but they may say, well, you're Sean D'Souza. You've been around in internet years forever, doing this for, I don't know, 15 years or so. You've already established yourself. So what would you do differently, or what would your approach be to stand out of the crowd if you started today?
I think you would have, you would have to do, let's take this, okay, a lot of cogitating happening there. Look at search engines, okay? So Yahoo and Hotbot and Lycos and Ask Jeeves and all of those existed before Google came along. Most of the time, when a new thing comes along, it's not doing some dramatic shift. It's doing a very small shift. So the most dominant player at the time of Google's entry was Yahoo. And Yahoo had all these clicking, shining, jumping things on their page. They have it to this day. And yeah, and Google, all they did was they made it simple. Just absolutely one box, and that was it. And technically, people didn't know whether they were getting a better result on Google or Yahoo, but they liked the fact that they didn't have to fight with this thing. So when people say, okay, you've been around for a long time, that's an advantage, but that's also a disadvantage. So you can walk into Google land and you can create something else. Hotels have existed for a long time, but then you have Airbnb. Yeah, you've had taxis for a long time, then you have Uber. And it's not a massive shift, because when you look at someone that wants to fight Uber, well, they can just take a little tweak and they can work with that tweak. I know it's not sounding very convincing now, because it takes a long time to explain how you could create that uniqueness. The first thing is that you must feel that you're competent enough to deliver that uniqueness. And until you feel that you're competent enough to deliver that uniqueness, it's difficult to say, okay, this is why I'm unique. Because uniqueness requires you to define what you do differently in a singular fashion. It's not like we're the fastest and best. It's like we're the fastest. Then what do you mean by fastest? So it needs you to be very specific. It needs you to hold on to one thing, just like Volvo holds on to speed. Domino's holds on to speed, but Volvo holds on to safety. So when you look at the car market, for instance, you're very clear. You know, what's the difference between a Corolla, a BMW, a Mercedes? You're clear in a Volvo, and the reason why you're clear is because they've spent many years doing just that. And if a new car comes in the market, which is what Tesla has done, they have differentiated themselves by being different, you know, by stating their difference. So I don't think it's a big advantage to be around forever, because or it's not a greater advantage, it's also a disadvantage. Most of the people have been around forever. If they don't kind of change or don't adapt, then they go the way of Nokia.
That's a good way to end this section of the podcast. I like that. So I have three questions that I ask of all of my guests. And the first is, what is the biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers?
I think the biggest mistake that I would see is that they think of their customers as people that they earn money from. They see them as some source of revenue. And our definition of a client is actually in the Webster's Dictionary. If you take all the words together and you look at a definition of a client, it says someone that comes under your care, guidance, and protection. So it is someone that you, where you're a parent, where you're a mentor, and you're caring, you're guiding, and protecting them. So that puts a sense of responsibility on you, which is totally different. And you say, well, how profitable is that? For us, it's been very profitable. When a client gets to know us and when we get to know them, and sometimes they don't buy anything from us. So for instance, there's a guy who's been writing to me now, and he's asked me half a dozen questions on email, and I answer all those questions, and you'd say, well, that takes a lot of time, and of course I can tell you how you make use of that information, but we won't go there now. But the point is that I see that as my responsibility, and if I don't do that, then he goes some other place, he spends $2,000, he spends $3,000, he wastes that money. Whose fault is that? To me, it's my fault. I didn't take that care responsibility. How does it pay off? Well, on average, once a client buys into one of our products, they buy into maybe six of the products. They will do probably 1 to 6 courses, and we run out of products and courses, and that's why they probably stop. But they'll come to our workshops. So when you consider that the article writing course is $3,000, so you look at 5 courses, that's $15,000, or between $10,000 to $15,000. You look at the products that we put out, some of them are $9.99, but some of them are $49, and some of them are $100. I don't know. You're looking at $15,000, $20,000 that a customer is willing to spend on you if you're going to pay attention, if you're going to help them. So there is a clear thing here. And the customer is not coming back because they're happy to just replenish your bank account, but they're coming because they're getting the benefit, they feel safe, they believe in your system. I won't say your ethics, but I would say your philosophy. And a lot of the stuff out there is about reducing the amount of time you spend with the customer. I mean, this is what made Zappos a big company, is that they got a strict order that if the customer is just calling you to talk about their day, talk about their day. It's not about getting them off the phone and getting the next sale. So that's the mistake that I think people take. I mean, they'll go and buy into a book like the 4-week, you know, the 4-hour work week, and they think, like, let me reduce all this workload to nothing and let me outsource everything. And for them, I specifically asked them, so if you buy into that concept and you sent me an email, would you prefer that I outsource that email?
Have you asked that question of someone?
I have. I've asked people. I mean, people buy into what seems to be an easy system. And it's like saying, don't you wish Leonardo da Vinci spent only 15 minutes painting the Mona Lisa? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make all the great work of art, all the great stuff, the best wines that we drink, the food that we eat, all the stuff that we absolutely adore is a product of creativity, but mostly of this effort, of this time that has been put in. The junk stuff, the stuff that costs a dollar that you throw out, that's an expression of, you know, let's outsource everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's the really good stuff, the stuff that, you know, that pen that you have, that handcrafted pen, which took half a year, that's the stuff that you want to pass on to your kids. Not the stuff that you just got, which was outsourced and just a production machine. Now, I'm not knocking the people that want to make a gazillion dollars just producing, mass producing stuff. If you want to outsource everything, that's your business. What I'm saying is that, how would you like it if you were to come to my business and I were to outsource you to one of a lackey, you know, just get somebody who's a lackey there and put them in charge of helping you? How would you like that? That's all I'm saying.
It's a very good question. Okay, so now I totally agree with you, by the way. One of the things that we like to say is that website visitors aren't clicks or, you know, a collection of anonymous kind of bots out there in the world. They're actual people, right? They're individuals, a collection of individuals who are interested in what you're doing. And the fact that they even end up on your website or interested in you in any way is kind of a cosmic miracle in a lot of ways. So you really should take a sense of responsibility when thinking about your clients. So with that said, what is the one thing that everyone can do today to learn about their clients?
I think they have to understand the biggest reason why clients don't buy, and that is a factor of risk. And that is not that they don't like you, not that they don't like your product. Now, admittedly, your product could do with changes, and you have to be clear about getting feedback, not testimonials, but feedback. Feedback is where they tell you what's wrong and you fix it. But I think that if you understand your client better, you understand what they want. I don't know how to put it. To me, it's you have to understand the factor is one of risk. They are not buying because they're not ready. You have not given them enough information to get them to buy. And once you do that, then life becomes a lot simpler for them and for you. And this is why a lot of our clients, you know, they'll go to a sales page, and after they sign up to a course or something, I'll ask them, so which part of the sales page did you read? And they say, I didn't read the sales page. And you say, how did you buy? And they say, you're a GPS. You know, when I go in my car, I don't check whether the GPS is working or not. I expect it to work. And so it reduces the amount of effort that the client has to make if you understand them and you craft your stuff so that it's to their benefit. So there's this whole factor of risk, and people don't understand that risk. But once you're able to take away the risk factor from the client, then they can buy all your stuff and as frequently as you need them to buy it, knowing fully well that you are care protecting and guiding them. And so that risk factor, you have to figure out what is that risk and then remove that risk. And that's the thing that people are not willing to do. And that's why you have to sell all the time.
Well, I think people are scared also that if they offer some sort of a risk removal, they're going to get hit with a huge amount of chargebacks. But I think the research supports something like a 2% refund rate on average. So assuming you have a credible and authentic product, it's actually going to really work in your favor.
I mean, we've done the article writing course since 2006. It's now 2016. In 10 years, we've had to overhaul the course by 20% every year. And the reason for that is that when you think of, say, your phone, the iPhone or Samsung or whatever, every time the new phone comes out or, say, Photoshop comes up with a new version of its software, you'll see that there is a dramatic shift. And if you have any doubts about it, go back to Photoshop 3 or go back to Photoshop 4 or go back to the phone that you had in 2001, and you'll see how many things you can't do. But the point is, how did all those features come in? And the features came in because people complained. People said, I would like this feature. This doesn't work. That doesn't work. And if you treat your product or your service like software, then you realize that this is version 2. Then it's going to be version 3. And that's what the brain audit, it's a version, it's 3.2. There was a version 1, there was a version 2, there's a version 3, there's a version 3.2. So what is happening there? And that is feedback. And there should be a version 4. I mean, the problem is as you go in the versions, it's you, what you get is bloatware. From software to bloatware, and that is difficult. It's like, how do you fit in the same stuff in 180 pages or 200 pages without it becoming this 500-page book?
Right, right. Yeah, that's definitely one of the challenges of collecting feedback, what to eliminate as you incorporate new things. So what is the one book that you recommend besides your own, which I think I've recommended for you a couple times, but the one book that you recommend listeners read?
I would say that changes. The book that I would recommend they read right now is called Badass. I mean, it's a terrible name, but it's B-A-D-A-S-S. And it's how to make your customers users or something like that. But it's written by Kathy Sierra. Right? And I would also recommend that you get a physical version of that book. It's terrible to read on the iPad. It's got a lot of graphics. It takes ages to download. I would order the physical version of it so that I could do some online writing stuff. It's got lots of graphics on it. And I would watch videos by Kathy Sierra. She talks about consumption, which is to make users, to get clients to get to the end of your product, to use it. It's something that we've been talking about since 2005 or 6. But she puts it in a different way, and the more people are talking about this, the better products and services we're going to have, hopefully.
Yeah, she has a fantastic video, just to add to your point, on YouTube at the XOXO conference, where she talks about the book, and it's a really succinct distillation of the core concepts of the book and why she was able to write a book that was so successful, because people actually applied it. Unlike, you know, you sell online courses and educational courses. A lot of people who do that kind of create a course and they don't think about the success of the user. We know that the attrition rate is like in the over 90% for a lot of people who take online courses. And obviously yours are very different. So, I agree that.
Yeah, we have the opposite. We have 90% completing the course. Mm-hmm. And the 10% that drop out are not because it's difficult. They drop out because, I don't know, there's suddenly a divorce, there's suddenly some major drama that's happening. Mm-hmm. But we have a 90, and I mean, you don't have to trust my thing for it. You can go on to, we can give you a list of anyone who's ever attended a course and find out, did they finish? Here's how you know they finished, okay? It's very simple. You know they finished because they come to another course. And then when they finish that course, they come to another course. So what they're getting is, the reason why they're coming back to another course is not because they like me so much. It's because they're getting a skill. So you do a cartooning course, you learn how to draw cartoons. You do the article writing course, you learn how to write articles. Why would you not go back? If I could learn French and German and Mandarin and Japanese, and every time I went there, I ended up finishing it, why would I not go back? It seems insane not to.
I totally agree. Well, Sean, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I'm really honored to have you on here, and I think you've given people a ton of value and shared your point of view and your, as you call it, a system of thinking about how to market and sell. So with that said, where can people find you? How can they follow up with you or learn more about you?
Well, let's take the risk out of them buying the brain audit, even though you can get it online for $9.99. You can go to psychotactics.com/xbrain. That's X for Xmas and B-R-A-I-N. So psychotactics.com/xbrain and get an X out of the book. You'll be hooked in a few pages.
I love the confidence of that pitch. Thank you so much, Sean. I really appreciate having you today. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you.